he believed. It took a single drop of liquid for the vessels to fill themselves over and over again. Mixed in with the shattered decanters was a broken hand mirror. The fractured glass cast back a cracked reflection of his bearded face.
7 years of bad luck.
He chuckled grimly as he picked up a shard. To be cursed by a mirror was the least of his problems. He turned his attention to a couple of lengths of wood. They were as long as his arm and had a grey, almost metallic shimmer to them. The grain was wayward and irregular.
What are they?
He supposed they could be cudgels. But what would they be doing in the bag? He tossed them carelessly onto the bed. The Maegar had written him a note. Furious with her for leaving Gerdlegard and for rummaging through his things, he left it unread. Then curiosity got the better of him.
The mystery is solved, or as good as. You were right. There is a way to defeat Nadon, and the books explain how. However, the means are beyond us, which is why I'm leaving Gerdlegard for good. The first book is an account of the Outer Lands that tells of a place called Barrenground, where demonic beings have the power to enter human souls, take possession of them, and invest them with extraordinary power. Men possessed of such demons are driven by an urge to destroy goodness wherever they find it, and bend everything to their will. The second book tells of a race called the Undergroundlings, who invented a mighty axe to destroy the demonic power. The blade of this axe must be made of the purest, hardest steel, with diamonds encrusting the bit, and an alloy of every known precious metal filling the inlay and the runes. The spurs should be hewn from stone, and the haft sculpted from wood of the Sigurdaisy tree. The axe must be forged in a furnace lit with the fiercest of all flames, and its name shall be Keenfire. This is the weapon with the power to slay the demonic spirits. Keenfire can slice through flesh and bone, cutting through the human body to destroy the evil presence within. Any harm that has been done reverts to good. Regrettably, I was unable to make sense of one passage, which means I cannot vouch for the method's success. The task is as good as hopeless. All the same, it explains why Nadon is interested in the artifacts. The bag contains two fragments of Sigurdaisy wood. The Sigurdaisy is extinct in Gerdlegard, but its wood is exceptionally hard. So hard that it can't be worked with ordinary tools. Humans used to believe that the trees were sacred, and they burned the wood for its powerful aroma and deep crimson flames. They stopped conducting the rituals when all the trees were gone. I once witnessed a Sigurdaisy fire in honor of Palandiel, but that was over 100 cycles ago.
Even if it were possible to make such a miraculous weapon, no one would get close enough to Nadon to slay him.
The whole business is ridiculous. If the dwarves have any sense, they will cross the ranges and settle in the Outer Lands. Maybe the Undergroundlings will give them shelter. My work here is done. Tungdil read and reread the letter until there was no further doubt. Lot Ionan's murderer was not completely invincible. They had everything they needed to kill him, even the wood. He hurried to find Belendilin. The counselor had lit a number of oil lamps, which bathed his chamber in light. Like the rest of Ogre's death, the room was hewn from rock, and the masons had even thought to sculpt a bed and cabinets. It looked as if the mountain had created a furnished chamber, especially for his use. Tungdil handed him the letter.
"There is mention in our records of distant kin on the far side of the mountain," he said when he saw the reference to the mysterious undergroundlings. "The inhabitants of the Outer Lands seem to have more experience of fighting the perished land."
Tungdil brandished the piece of parchment.
"It explains why Nadon was desperate to get his hands on the books and the bag." "Well, it's too late now. His secret is out. Belendilin, you've got to tell the human sovereigns of our discovery before they lose all hope. They need to keep the Maegars fighting while we work on the weapon. If only they can keep him busy until then."
Belendilin studied the passages relating to the making of the axe. "We'll have to enlist the help of the Fourthlings. Their skill in diamond cutting is unsurpassed. Our people can take care of the stone, but as for the best smiths..."
"Borengar's folk."
"Yes, but none of their 9 clans are here. The Firstlings ignored our summons. Geselbert's Fifthlings were exceptional blacksmiths, but their line was snuffed out."
Belendilin scowled.
"And that's not the only hitch. The fiercest furnace in Girdlegard belonged to the Fifthlings. Its name was Dragonfire, and the hardest metal would melt in its flames. But the Grey Range has been in the hands of the Perished Land for over 1,000 cycles. He rested his head in his hands. Omega was right. It's not possible.
We can't give up now. Call a meeting and let the delegates decide. We need to send word to the Firstlings and ask for their assistance. Then we'll...
He trailed off.
Well, I'll take a look in the archives. Maybe I'll find something that will help.
Good luck to you, Tangil.
The dwarf left the chamber and headed for the vaults, where the written record of the Secondling's history was preserved. Now that the initial excitement was over, he was left with the sobering realization that they were barely any closer to saving Girdlegard from Nodon's grasp.
I'm not giving up.
The very hopelessness of the situation made Tungdil more determined than ever to succeed. He settled down to his task with all the stubbornness and persistence typical of his race. It was his solemn intention not to leave the Secondling's archives until he found something of use. Tungdil hurried back and forth, fetching ancient tomes, rolls of parchment, and stone tablets from their places in the vaults. He piled everything on a table to examine it at length.
Lot Ionan must have known that my schooling would come in handy.
Some of the parchment was so fragile that it tore or crumbled at his touch. It made Tungdil appreciate the durability of the marble tablets that lasted an eternity, provided they weren't dropped. After a good deal of reading, he found evidence to back up Belendilin's vague assertions about the undergroundlings. According to the archives, a race of dwarves on the other side of the ranges went by that name. Whether or not Vrakas had created them was anyone's guess, but they seemed to have much in common with the children of the smith. They were accomplished metalworkers and shared the dwarven passion for the forge. On the fourth orbit, he learned the secret of Dragonfire, and his optimism, which had survived in spite of everything, was dealt a grievous blow. The flames of the Fifthling's fiery furnace had been lit by the white tongue of Bran Busil, a dragon who had roamed the Grey Range until Giselbert's dwarves stole its fire, killed it, and seized its hoard. Argamas, its mate, had taken refuge in Flamemere, a small lake of molten lava at the heart of the Fifthling Kingdom. The creature had never been seen again. The stolen fire enabled the dwarves to heat their furnace to phenomenal temperatures and create alloys from metals that had never been melded. Dragonfire was powerful enough to melt Teonium, the black element created by Teon, and combine it with Palladium, the deity's pure white metal. Later records indicated that the furnace had fallen with the Fifthlings. Neither the Alfar nor any other creature of Teon could find a use for the strange white flames, and Dragonfire had been extinguished. Tungdil's only hope lay in finding the dragon's mate, who had escaped the dwarves' axes. If the Firstlings could provide a smith, and Argamas could furnish the fire, Keenfire could be forged, and Nodon defeated.
More travelling, he sighed. We'll have to go west to the Firstlings, then north through the heart of the Perished Land to the lost Fifthling Kingdom. But how are we supposed to cross Girdlegard without Nodon finding out?
He put the question to Gundrabur and Belendilin when he met them in the Great Hall to report on his findings and share a keg of beer. The king and his counsellor looked at each other knowingly.
There is a way, the High King told him. A secret way that has faded from memory over the cycles. My predecessor told me of it.
He lit his pipe and sucked on it vigorously.
It dates back to the glorious orbits of old. In those happy times, travelling was easy. We used underground tunnels that crisscrossed the whole of Girdlegard, linking our kingdoms. Tunnels, so we could travel unseen. With ponies, we could... You won't need ponies. You'll get there soon enough.
Gundrabur pulled his cloak tighter and sent for another blanket. His inner furnace was burning worryingly low. Tungdil frowned.
I don't follow.
You've seen the wagons carrying iron ore through the mines?
Sure, but...
Then he grasped what the High King was saying.
We can go by wagon.
Gundrabur smiled.
Indeed. Our forefathers used wagons to travel by the shortest route from the Firstling Kingdom to the Secondling Kingdom, and the Secondling Kingdom to the Fourthling Kingdom, and so forth, unimpeded by marshland, wilderness, rain or snow. They could convey troops wherever they wanted in no time at all. Within a matter of orbits, an entire army could cross from north to south, undetected by men, elves or magi.
That's the answer!
Tungdil cried excitedly.
If the tunnels are still intact, we'll be able to forge the axe before the Dark Magus has time to defeat the human armies and conquer their kingdoms.
I can't guarantee what kind of state they're in, warned Gundrabur. According to the ancient records, some sections of the tunnels have collapsed. Belendilin, fetch the maps.
Why hasn't anyone come across them since?
The entrance lies in an area of the Blue Range that became polluted with sulfurous gas. Our kinsfolk abandoned that side of the mountain, and the tunnels were forgotten.
At length, Belendilin returned with two ancient maps, showing the path of the tunnels through the Secondling Kingdom. The tunnels cut straight through the heart of the Blue Range, and were well hidden, with numerous mechanisms and traps securing them against intruders. Even if Teon's creatures had known about the tunnels, there was no way of breaking into them, so the forces of darkness were obliged to conduct their invasion overland.
Well, that's settled, Tungdil told the others. I'll do it.
Good, said Belendilin with a smile.
He refilled their tankards.
In that case, you should be the one who tells the assembly of the tunnel's existence. The delegates will be impressed.
They clunked tankards and drank.
Vrakas made me party to this knowledge, so that the dwarves could liberate Girdlegard from evil, said Tungdil, coming to the end of his impassioned speech. Why else would he have given me the artifacts and books?
Forgotten relics from a glorious era,
Gandagar said scornfully.
Nothing you've stumbled upon is of any practical use. A miracle axe to be forged secretly in a furnace fired by dragon's breath at the heart of the perished land, it can't be done. If you ask me, the whole thing's a fiction, a legend that found its way into our archives by mistake.
You may not believe it, Tungdil cut in, but Nodon clearly does. He wiped out a whole settlement to get his hands on the books. He tried to kill me, too. Why would he be so worried if it were just an old story?
Clansmen, he begged the assembly, we need to send an expedition. Vrakas will see us through this.
Of course he will, jeered Bislapur. If you don't mind my asking, how exactly were you intending to slay the dragon? They're tough old beasts, but tell it one of your stories, and the poor thing will probably die of laughter on the spot.
The roars of merriment were enough to convince Tungdil not to put the matter to the vote. The motion would only fail. Common sense had yet to bludgeon its way into the delegates' thick skulls.
To business,
Gandagar said impatiently. He threw off his cloak, revealing a shimmering mail shirt. His adviser handed him his shield and his axe, while another fastened his helmet.
The purpose of this meeting is to decide the succession. Let the contest begin. For the first task, I challenge my rival to a duel. Victory will go to whoever draws first blood, or forces his opponent to his knees.
In an instant, Boindil and Boendal were at Tungdil's side, helping him on with his armor. His metal tunic looked cheap and dull compared to Gandagar's glittering mail.
"Beware of his shield. He's bound to try to ram you with it,"
whispered Boindil. He clenched his fists.
"If only I could take your place," he growled. "I'd hammer him into the marble."
"You've been wonderful teachers,"
Tungdil reassured the twins as he buckled his chinstrap. "And I'm not just talking about the past few orbits. You taught me a great deal during our journey as well. If I lose, it won't be because of you." The two candidates stepped into the semicircle between the throne and the benches. Belendilin acted as referee. His eyes smiled reassuringly at Tungdil.
"Fight valiantly and honorably," he told them as he backed away.
The rivals were alone in the arena. The Fourthling King lost no time in launching his attack. Tungdil parried blow after blow, all the while trying not to be distracted by the twinkling diamonds on Gandagar's axe. He watched the swooping trajectory of the blade from behind his shield, retreating farther and farther until his back came up against a column. As the next blow swung toward him, Tungdil ducked and struck back.
There was a shrill metallic shriek as his blunted axe scraped over Gandogar's hastily raised shield and struck the lower edge of his helmet. Head spinning, the king staggered back.
"No attack!"
yelled Boindil, caught up in the excitement. Fired on by his success and the encouragement of his tutor, Tungdil rushed forward.
"Not if I can help it."
Bislapur had no intention of allowing Gandogar to be defeated. Sverd was standing beside him, so he gave him a little shove. The gnome pitched forward and struck his head on a tankard. Beer slopped to the floor. The incident was Tungdil's undoing. In his haste, he didn't notice that the slippery marble floor was as treacherous as an ice rink. His right foot skidded to the side. He struggled to keep his balance and flailed out vainly with his axe.
"Foolish gnome!"
Bislapur unleashed a volley of curses, threatening to thrash the hapless Sverd and tighten his collar until it cut off his breath.
"The scoundrel did it on purpose!" protested Boendal. "He's just clumsy, that's all. He'll pay for this, believe me," said Bislapur, still pretending to be furious with the gnome.
None of that was any comfort to Tungdil, who skidded past Gandogar just as the latter straightened up and took aim. The king's axe thwacked his back with enough force to send him spinning out of control. Cursing, he lost his footing and forfeited the task. A cheer went up from the Forthling corner, where Gandogar's supporters were gathered. The jubilation turned to mocking laughter when Tungdil struggled to his feet. The contest wasn't unfolding quite as he'd hoped.
"Now for my task!"
he shouted above the din. The great hall fell silent.
"What's the nature of the challenge?"
"We shall both transcribe a text. The first to finish wins."
"What?"
Gandogar protested.
"I'm a king, not a poet."
"You don't have to be a poet. All you have to do is write. A good monarch must have a steady hand and a smart mind to guide it. How else would he make the laws? But maybe fighting is your only virtue." Without further ado, he sat down at a desk and waited for Gandogar to follow suit.
"What if I refuse?"
"If you refuse," said Belendalin, "you'll lose the challenge and the tally will be one task each, leaving the succession to be decided by the final three challenges."
"Besides,"
Boendal added snidely,
"it would be cowardly not to accept. The scholar wasn't afraid to face your axe. I hope the Forthling leader isn't frightened of a quill."
The jibe and resulting hilarity prompted Gandogar to lay down his shield and helmet and take a seat at the desk. The referee called for the rolls of parchment and chose one at random.
"You may begin."
In no time, the scholar, as Boendal jokingly called him, was scribbling furiously, while his opponent glared at the runes and scratched awkwardly at the parchment with his quill. The dwarves devoted themselves to the task in industrious silence.
"Finished,"
declared Tungdil at length. His work was scrutinized and found to be faultless. Gandogar took longer and made several errors along the way. Belendalin awarded the task to Tungdil. The twins whooped in delight, pleased that their charge had used his cunning to secure a draw.
"Too bad you lost that one, eh, Bislapur?"
Boindil shouted cheerfully. At Belendalin's request, the delegates noted down their challenges, and the slips of paper were collected. Gandogar would draw first, then Tungdil.
"For the next challenge," announced the referee, "you will forge an axe from the poorest quality iron and strike it 10 times against a shield without fracturing the blade."
Tungdil had spent so much time at Lotionen's anvil that he was sure he would prove the superior smith. Belendalin declared a break in the proceedings while the necessary equipment was set up in the hall, and soon the high-ceilinged chamber was echoing with the sound of ringing hammers. Tungdil hit his stride, working in time with a dwarven ballad that had been taught to him by the twins. Not to be outdone, Gandogar belted out a song of his own and hammered all the more furiously.
"You'd think it was a singing competition,"
Boendal grinned and hoisted his belt.
"If that doesn't please Vrakas, I don't know what will." "Tungdil is the better singer, so Vrakas will favour his cause," said his brother.
The singing continued until both candidates had finished their blades. Belendalin instructed them to attach the axe heads to iron hafts. Then each took up the other's weapon, ensuring the blade's exposure to maximum force. They positioned themselves in front of their shields, and at the referee's signal, the contest began.
"Let's see how His Majesty fared in the forge," said a sweat-drenched Tungdil, preparing to strike.
The blade, still glowing with heat, traced an orange semicircle through the gloom of the hall, hitting its target in a shower of sparks. The axe withstood the blow.
"Better than you thought," retorted Gandogar.
He struck the shield with equal force, and the blade held true. They dealt 6 further blows apiece, but on the 8th strike, Tungdil heard a faint crack when Gandogar's axe hit the shield. He knew the next blow would be its last.
"Take a look at this," he called to the king.
The blade fractured, shattering into countless shards. Panting, Tungdil threw the haft to the floor and fumbled for his water pouch. A murmur went through the watching crowd. The Fourthling king tensed his muscles, summoning all his strength for the final blow. The shield groaned and shuddered, but the blade survived the strike.
"Hurrah for the smith!" boomed Boindil. 2-1 to Tungdil! It was the singing that did it. Even the poorest metal can't resist a good tune.
Gandogar laid down his axe in order to shake his opponent's hand.
"I didn't think anyone could forge such a fine blade from such woefully inadequate metal. You are the undisputed master of the forge. But I shall be king of the dwarves. The next victory will be mine."
"We'll see about that."
Already Belendilin was unfolding the next piece of paper. There was no time for the dwarves to catch their breath. "The 4th challenge will be a race. Each candidate will be given a tankard of molten gold and must carry it to the end of the first meadow and back before proceeding to the gates. In addition to your chainmail, you will be given a pack weighing precisely 40 pounds. The first to return with a full tankard wins the task." To ensure that both competitors ran the full distance with their tankards, Belendilin dispatched a pair of dwarves to the meadow and another to the gates.
"This is my kind of task," thought Tungdil, hefting the knapsack to his shoulders.
He was accustomed to the heat of the forge, and as for carrying gold, it was more of a privilege than a burden. Even the thought of racing with a 40-pound knapsack didn't deter him. He had walked hundreds of miles across Girdlegard with 2 heavy packs. They were handed their tankards, thick-rimmed glass vessels with a thin layer of pewter plating. The contents had been heated to several hundred degrees, and would sear through the flesh on contact with the skin. There was an obvious risk of serious injury. Even the steam rising from the molten metal was treacherously hot.
"Go!"
shouted Belendilin. With that, the race was underway. Gandogar surged forward, barely glancing at his tankard as he focused on his course. Tungdil took the opposite approach, feasting his eyes on the pool of liquid sunshine. He had marched for enough miles to have faith in his footing. Soon the king was in the lead and had vanished from the hall. Tungdil followed leisurely. Belendilin had said that the task would be won by the first to return with a full tankard. He would rather take his time and bring back his quota than waste any of the precious gold. He even stopped and set down his tankard occasionally to give his calloused smith's hands a chance to recover from the heat. He had almost reached the valley when Gandogar raced past in the opposite direction.
"You'd better hurry if you want to beat me, Tungdil," he shouted.
There was an unmistakable whiff of scorched skin, but the king kept going regardless, content to let his fingers suffer. As far as Tungdil could tell, not a drop of gold had been spilled. He stopped in the meadow, gave his hand a quick rest, and set off in hot pursuit.
"I shouldn't have counted on Gandogar making a mistake," he admonished himself.
It wasn't long before his hand began to shake. He was feeling the effects of the duel and the metalworking contest, but no amount of self-pity was going to help him win the task. He was just approaching the gates when Gandogar ran past, sweating and cursing, on his homeward leg. The Fourthling smiled cockily at Tungdil, his tankard still full.
"We're even now! One last challenge and victory will be mine," he vowed.
That was enough to revive Tungdil's competitive spirit, and he hurried after Gandogar, determined to pass him as quickly as he could. Just then, a small creature darted into the passageway and collided with his legs. Tungdil stumbled and caught himself.
"What in the name of Fracas?"
The molten gold was swirling dangerously, ready to spill over the edge, but Tungdil had no intention of releasing his grip. A golden wave slopped over the side and splashed onto his skin. The pain was excruciating, but he gritted his teeth and continued without so much as a curse. His eyes scanned the passageway furiously, but the offending creature was gone. Owing to the mishap, he reached the hall in second place, and without his full quota of gold. He had lost by either reckoning. But Gandagar's victory had not been won without sacrifice, and his poor, scalded hands were being treated with ice and water by a nurse. This time it fell to Tungdil to congratulate his rival. He refrained from shaking his hand out of consideration for his burns.
"Well, you kept your promise this time," he said,
immersing his own tender skin in the ice-cold water.
"Don't worry, I intend to keep all my promises,"
Gandagar informed him, turning quickly away. Tungdil held up his hand to inspect the damage. The gold had solidified, leaving a permanent coin-sized patch on his skin. The golden stain made his right hand glisten in the light of the coal lamps, catching Boindil's eye.
"Take a look at that, brother."
"Tungdil Goldhand, that's what we'll call him," said Boindil. "I hope he likes it. I reckon it suits him well."
"It's a damn sight better than Bolifar,"
his twin agreed.
"Attention, delegates," called Belendalin. "The score stands at 2-2, so we must progress to the fifth and final challenge, on which the choice of successor and the future of the dwarven folks shall rest."
He instructed the rivals to note down a maximum of 4 tasks.
"It has to be something I can definitely win," Tungdil thought for a moment, then grinned.
"Of course."
The perfect task had occurred to him in the nick of time. Each slip of paper was folded in the same fashion and placed in a leather pouch held open by Belendalin. The councillor pulled the drawstrings, gave the bag a good shake, and paced along the row of dwarves, stopping in front of Bislipur.
"Once the task has been drawn, there can be no complaints about the fairness of the choice. Bislipur, my friend, I should like you to pick the challenge."
He held the pouch toward him. The thick-set dwarf seized the bag without any pretense at politeness. He fixed the councillor with a stony glare. Without looking down, he reached inside the bag, swept the bottom, and came up with a slip of paper. He was about to unfold it when the parchment slipped out of his fingers and fell back into the pouch. His hand plunged after it, and he thrust the note wordlessly toward Belendalin.
"No," said the referee. "You pick the task, you read it."
Bislipur shifted his gaze from the councillor's face to the note. He unfolded the paper and scanned its contents.
"Oh," he said breezily, "that's not the one I drew first."
He reached inside the bag again.
"Rules are rules."
Belendalin snatched the pouch away.
"You made your choice, now read out the challenge."
Bislipur's jaw was clenched as if to hold back the challenge and prevent it from reaching the delegate's ears. He took a deep breath, hesitating for so long that Tungdil began to hope.
"The fifth and final task is an expedition," he announced,
his voice trembling with rage.
"The candidates are challenged to journey to the Grey Range and return with keen fire. The winner will wield the axe against Nodon."
There was a faint sigh as Gundrabor released his pent-up breath in relief. Belendalin closed his eyes and permitted himself the briefest of smiles. No one could have anticipated that the greatest challenge to Gandagar's succession would come from a task chosen and read by Bislipur himself. It was obvious that Tungdil was far cleverer than his fellow dwarves had thought. Silence descended on the hall as the delegates digested the unexpected twist. Tungdil stepped forward quickly to forestall any protests about the nature of the task.
"I issued the challenge, and I accept."
He turned to Gandagar. The Fourthling King was visibly seething.
"Ditto,"
he growled.
"Stop, we must draw again,"
insisted Bislipur, knowing that an expedition to the Grey Range would sabotage his plan for a war against the elves.
"You saw me drop the first note, this isn't the right one."
Belendalin stood his ground.
"What do you propose I do? We'll never know which note was drawn first. No, the decision must stand. Both candidates have accepted the challenge, and the outcome will decide the succession."
But what of the delay? Protested Bislapur. An expedition will saddle us with orbits of uncertainty.
Please don't worry unduly, Tungdil said politely. I'll endeavour to return as quickly as I can.
The delegates laughed.
If you'll excuse me, I need to get going and choose my travelling companions. There's no time to waste.
He signalled to Boendal and Boindil to follow.
I would never have got this far if it hadn't been for you. With your agreement, I should like you to accompany me on my expedition to the Grey Range. Can I count on your assistance in escorting me there and back again?
Boindil guffawed.
Did you hear that, brother? He's the same old scholar.
He turned to Tungdil.
We'd be honored to join you, but only if you promise to drop your fancy speech. Besides, he added with a tinge of sadness, there's the matter of restoring my good reputation after I failed you in the desert.
Tungdil placed his hands on the brother's shoulders.
Don't worry, Boindil. I'm sure you'll have more than enough opportunities to save me from certain death.
The dwarf grinned, and his brother nodded.
You earned yourself a new name today, scholar.
Boendal pointed to the shimmering metal grafted to his skin.
Tungdil Goldhand. What do you think of that?
Goldhand.
Tungdil held up his right hand.
Yes, I rather like the sound of it.
His hand hurt devilishly, but he managed a smile.
Goldhand. A proper dwarven name.
The delegates dispersed, and Bislapur and Gandagar stormed out of the Great Hall, leaving the High King and his counsellor alone.
Was that your idea?
Inquired Gundrabur, reaching for his pipe.
Belendalin laughed softly. Not at all. I would never have come up with such a preposterous suggestion. If you ask me, Tungdil was sent here by Vrakas himself.
He ascended the dais and stood by the throne.
He'd make an excellent High King, you know. His ideas are pure gold.
Tungdil chose wisely,
agreed the monarch.
Whichever of the candidates comes back first, Gerdegard will be the real winner. And of course the dwarves. Our task is to make sure nothing untoward happens while the two of them are away.
It means keeping your inner furnace alight a little longer,
Belendalin reminded him anxiously. Gundrabur levered himself out of his throne and stuck his pipe between his teeth.
Vrakas knows our need, and will stay his hammer until the time has come,
he said, undaunted.
His counsellor watched him go, then sat down on the footstool to examine the contents of the leather pouch.
His efforts were focused on finding the slip of paper that Bislapur had originally drawn. He knew it as soon as he saw it, because of the nick in one corner. Bislapur's expression on reading the challenge had discouraged him from intervening and correcting the mistake. And rightly so, as he discovered when he opened the note. If Bislapur had kept hold of the paper, Tungdil would be cutting diamonds instead of preparing for his quest.
He would have lost the challenge, and Gandagar would be High King.
He unfolded the other slips of paper and laughed out loud. 4 times diamond cutting and 4 times an expedition.
Thank Vrakas for Bislapur's clumsiness, he thought, chuckling in relief.
Chapter 11 Beroween's Folk, Secondling Kingdom, Gerdlegard, Autumn, 6234th Solar Cycle. Knowing that he would require the services of a mason, Tungdil had asked the High King's counsellor to recruit a suitable artisan from the Secondling clans. Belendalin felt strongly that the final decision should rest with Tungdil, and so it was agreed that a group of candidates would be selected for him to take his pick. Not long afterward, a one-eyed dwarf knocked on Tungdil's door. Tungdil looked him over in surprise.
Are you the only one?
Belendalin promised to narrow it down, but I didn't expect him to be quite so ruthless. Who are you?
Bavragor Hammerfist, of the clan of the Hammerfists, mason and stoneworker of 200 cycles.
His bear-like hands reminded Tungdil of Belendalin. His black hair hung loose about his shoulders, and his beard was artfully shaped around his cheeks and chin.
My masonry is second to none, and my right eye sees twice as keenly as 2. Nothing escapes me, not the tiniest fault in the stone, nor the slightest flaw in the working of it.
Tungdil explained that the expedition required a mason to fashion the spurs for an axe.
Since the blade was to be forged in the Grey Range, the other components of the weapon would be made and assembled there.
Which means journeying through the perished land. It's bound to be hazardous. Only Vrakas knows what will befall us.
Tungdil left the briefing at that and looked the mason in the eye. A dark red ring encircled the brown iris.
How peculiar.
Count me in, said Bavragor.
He held out his hand.
Let's shake on it. Do you promise that I, Bavragor Hammerfist, will be your one and only mason?
Tungdil obliged by clasping his hand and giving his word. The mason grinned and seemed almost relieved.
When are we leaving?
In 2 orbits time. I need to recruit a diamond cutter from the Forthling delegation.
And then I'll start packing. A weapon like Keenfire deserves my finest tools.
He hurried from the room. Tungdil had expected the interview to last a little longer, but he soon forgot about the mason and turned his attention to finding a diamond cutter. None of the Forthlings could be expected to join his company of their own accord, so he was obliged to ask Gandagar to spare him a suitable dwarf. The strategy was safer than it sounded. The Forthling delegation was composed of first-rate artisans and warriors, as tradition dictated. The more Tungdil thought about it, the less inclined he was to ask his rival for a favor. But in the end he swallowed his pride, reminding himself that vanity was a luxury when Gerdlegard's future was at stake. He was just leaving his chamber when he saw 4 dwarves hurrying down the passageway toward him. One by one they introduced themselves.
Belendilin sent us. He says you're to choose.
Bewildered, Tungdil stared at the bearded countenances looking at him expectantly.
I've made my choice, he said.
It hadn't occurred to him that there might be other candidates. Now he was regretting his haste.
I chose Bavragor.
Bavragor Hammerfist? Not Bavragor who polishes the stone with the beer on his breath, said one of the dwarves incredulously. Not the merry minstrel.
He got here first.
He didn't make the final cut. You can't take him.
The masons looked at him, aghast.
He's been trying to drown himself in beer for as long as anyone can remember. 4 full tankards are barely enough to steady his hands.
I gave him my word. I can't go back on it now.
Tungdil's cheeks flushed with fury when he realized that he'd walked straight into the one-eyed mason's trap.
I shall ask him to release me from our agreement.
The secondlings directed him to Bavragor's favorite tavern, and Tungdil marched off to give the trickster a piece of his mind. He soon found the place. A line of lamp-lit columns ran down the center of the barrel-vaulted chamber, and lanterns dangled from the ceiling, casting golden halos through panes of tinted glass. At the far end was a stone-hewn counter, where 4 barmaids were filling tankards from huge dark barrels and carrying them to the waiting clientele. The band was made up of 2 crumhorns, a stone flute, and a drum, whose task consisted mainly of accompanying the rowdy choir. Bavragor was sitting at a table with a group of laborers who had come straight from the quarry and were covered in dust. He was celebrating his selection for the expedition in time-worn mason's fashion, waving his tankard and singing at a volume that sent tremors through the room. Beer slopped out of his tankard, spattering his brown leather breeches with white froth.
Bavragor!
Tungdil shouted sternly.
Ah, the High King-to-be!
The mason raised his vessel.
3 cheers for Tungdil Goldhand!
His drinking companions joined in, raising their tankards and scrambling to their feet in a fog of grey dust. Tungdil seethed. In a few determined strides, he crossed the tavern, tore the tankard from Bavragor's hand, and slammed it onto the table.
Belendilin didn't send you to me. You tricked me into giving you my word, and now I want you to release me.
Oops, careful there. That's good beer you're spilling.
The mason gave him an innocent smile.
I didn't actually say that Belendilin sent me, did I?
Tungdil was lost for words.
Well, no, you didn't, but...
Bavragor picked up his tankard.
Was it part of the deal?
Yes, I mean, no.
Look, here's what happened. I came in, asked for the job, and you agreed. We shook hands. You gave me your word of honor, and that was that.
He took a long gulp.
In any case, you made the right choice. There's no better mason than me. I expect you saw my work when you got here. Inscriptions, statues, the lot. Pretty impressive, I'd say.
He raised his right hand.
This is the hand that you shook, and your grip was true. The sooner you find a diamond cutter, the better. We can't hang around forever.
He turned back to his fellow drinkers and launched into song.
Tricked by a drunkard!
Speechless with rage, Tungdil stomped off to find Gandagar. He tried to swallow his anger and think about it logically. Perhaps Bavrogor really was the best mason in the Secondling Kingdom, but it didn't make up for his bare-faced cheek. He was halfway down the corridor when he suddenly burst out laughing. It was almost as if Vrakas were trying to demonstrate that a little bravado could go a long way. The smith had shown a fine sense of irony in saddling him, the false heir to the throne, with an impudent drunkard who had bluffed his way into the mason's role. I'll have to remember to pack enough brandy and beer to steady his hands when we reach the Grey Range. At least Belendaline will be able to tell me whether he's really as good as he claims. Tangdil fetched one of the two lengths of sigadaisy wood and entered the assembly room where Gandagar was waiting. The Fourthling monarch was sitting at the table with five of his entourage. Tangdil was struck by their glittering jewels and diamonds. Compared to the Secondlings, their tunics and mail were unashamedly ostentatious.
It's not in my nature to make others beg. You don't need to explain yourself, Tangdil. I know what you want.
He pointed to the delegates, who rose to their feet.
Take your pick. They're all expert craftsmen, masters in the art of cutting and polishing gems.
Tungdil paced along the line of dwarves, studying their faces and allowing his instincts to guide him. The artisans were a little on the small side, but for some reason he was drawn to the puniest of the lot. Something told him that this was the one. The dwarf's beard glittered with diamond dust that had caught in his curly whiskers. It looked as though thousands of tiny stars were shimmering under his chin. Tungdil's mind was made up.
Goimgar Shimmerbeard, said Gandagar, introducing him. A fine choice, he added.
The artisan's nervousness turned into full-blown panic. He turned to his monarch.
But Gandagar, your highness, surely you won't make me... You know that I can't...
I gave Tungdil a free choice, Gandagar said sharply. Do you want me to break my promise? You're going with Tungdil, and that's that.
But, your majesty...
The artisan stuttered desperately.
Think of the reputation of our folk. Do exactly as Tungdil tells you, and if you get to the Grey Range before us, be sure to cut the diamonds as conscientiously as you would for me. Farewell. And, Goimgar, come back in one piece.
The king rose and signalled for the remaining four dwarves to follow. When he reached the door, he stopped and turned.
I don't want you to come to any harm, Tungdil Goldhand. But as the rightful heir, I can't honestly wish you well. Vrakas will lead me to victory and expose you as a sham. I will be Gundrabor's successor.
You can have the title, King Gandagar, Tungdil said graciously, handing him the sigadaisy wood. Just remember to slay Nadon and protect Gerdlegard and our kingdoms from harm. He hurried away without waiting for a reply. The scrawny artisan followed him, eyes cast gloomily to the floor. Tungdil, Bavrogor, Goimgar and the twins were sitting in the central hall of the library, a ribbed vault lined with lamps and mirrors that afforded sufficient light for reading and study. All around them were tablets and rolls of parchment, the collected knowledge of hundreds of cycles. The archive, the Secondling's repository of the past, seemed the ideal place to hold a meeting about the future. Tungdil unrolled a map showing the territory between the five ranges. We'll go down and take a look at the entrance to the underground network, he told them. With a bit of luck, and the blessing of Vrakas, we'll be able to travel west.
You mean north?
Interrupted Bavrogor. The strapping dwarf leaned forward and pointed at the Grey Range.
We need to go north.
Sure, but first we'll go west, to Borengar's folk. The Firstlings have always been the best smiths. They're the only ones capable of forging the blade.
That's as maybe,
objected Bavrogor, giving Tungdil a searching look with his right eye.
But who's to say they're still there?
For all we know, they may have been wiped out by orcs.
He reached for his beer.
We should take a smith with us and head north right away.
Ah, said Boendal. So we've got a new leader, have we? Don't tell me you want to be High King as well.
I wouldn't mind being High King if it meant I could lock up maniacs like your brother,
the mason retorted harshly. Boendil frowned, his hand moving automatically to his axe.
Careful, One-Eye, or you'll end up blind.
They never liked each other, Boendal explained in a whisper. The incident with Bavrigor's sister only made things worse.
Tungdil sighed. He had a nasty feeling that the journey was going to be harder than he'd thought.
His sister? I'll tell you later, hissed Boendal. They'll only end up fighting, or worse.
What are we going to do with the dragon if we actually find it?
Asked Goimgar. The skinny artisan was barely half the width of Bavrigor or the twins.
If you ask me, the whole thing sounds dangerous. Orcs, the Perish Land, Alfar, a dragon?
He swallowed nervously.
I must say, I'm a bit concerned.
Concerned? It's going to be fabulous!
Bellowed Boindil, clapping him on the back. Goimgar winced in pain.
We all like a good bit of orc baiting, don't we? It's good dwarven fun.
True to his name, Goimgar's beard shimmered in the candlelight.
Speak for yourself, I'd rather be in my workshop.
Boindil eyed him suspiciously.
You do know how to use an axe, don't you? You sound more like a whining longin than a child of the smith.
He jumped up and threw him an axe.
Come on, then. Show us how you fight.
The axe clattered across the floor and slid to a halt in front of Goimgar, who left it where it lay. He patted his sword.
I'd rather use this and my shield,
he said peevishly, offended by the secondling's mocking tone.
Call that a sword? It looks more like a bread knife. A gnome would be too embarrassed to use a pathetic blade like that.
Boindil whinnied with laughter.
By the beard of Vrakas, you must have been hewn from soapstone.
He sat down, shaking his head in despair. Bavrigor chuckled into his beer, emptied his tankard, and burped. On the subject of Goimgar, the two arch-enemies were united in scorn. Boendal turned his attention to the map.
We'll be able to get to the Firstling Kingdom without coming up against the Perish Land. Let's hope we can use the tunnels. I wonder what kind of state they're in.
I expect we'll find out when our wagon hits a broken sleeper and we plunge to our deaths,
Goimgar said despondently.
No one's been in the tunnels for cycles and cycles. It'll be a miracle if...
Now I know why Gandalgar said we could take you with us. What a pomace-hearted weakling you are. I've never heard so much wailing and sighing,
Boindil said scornfully. Bavrigor eyed him coldly.
If you'd been at my sister's funeral...
Enough!
Tungdil silenced them. He was starting to have serious doubts about his ability to hold the group together.
Vrakas, give me strength. Is this an expedition for dwarves or for children? No one would ever guess that you're older than me. We're not visiting a gold mine or a salt works. We're supposed to be saving Gerdlegard.
Oh, I thought we were risking our lives so you could steal the throne,
Goimgar said spitefully. Bavrigor turned his tankard upside down and caught the last drops in his hand. He licked them up regretfully. Tungdil smiled at the artisan.
No, Goimgar, that's not true. Our priority is to forge a weapon that will slay Nadon and give us the means to fight the Perish Land. Without Keenfire, we don't stand a chance.
He hadn't let on that he was missing a section of the instructions for Keenfire that Andakai hadn't managed to translate.
Is that how you're planning to persuade the Firstlings to lend us their best smith?
The mason asked derisively.
They probably never heard of the Magus or the Perished Land.
Tungdil looked from Bavrigor to Goimgar and back again.
Why are you two so keen to make problems before we've even started? He asked frankly.
Bavrigor scratched his beard.
I'm not the one who's sitting here chatting, he retorted. But if you want my opinion, we'll need more than Vrakas's blessing if we're to forge the blade and make it back across Gerdlegard.
Then take it from me that he'll give us his blessing and more. If you'd experience half the adventures that I went through on my journey,
you wouldn't be so skeptical. And remember, Bavrigor, we're not doing this for me. We're doing it for Girdlegard and the dwarves.
And for Lotionen, Frala, Sunya and Ikana, he added silently. He smiled.
Just think, if we're lucky, we'll find some gold.
Well, I'd drink to that, but I need some more beer, said the mason.
He lumbered out of the room. Tungdil turned to Goimgar.
What about you? Do you see why we're doing this?
Absolutely, for Girdlegard, like you said.
The flippant response did little to satisfy Tungdil, who tried to look him in the eye. Goimgar stared fixedly at the bookshelves that lined the walls from floor to ceiling. It wasn't long before Bavrigor returned with an even larger tankard, having drunk at least half of its contents on the way.
To the next High King,
he said loudly, omitting to stipulate which of the candidates he had in mind.
I hope he achieves all his goals.
He downed the rest of his drink.
He hasn't even stopped for breath,
Boindil said in astonishment.
There must be a lick of the stuff inside him.
Bavrigor wiped the froth from his beard.
Back in a minute,
he said, rising to leave.
Stop,
commanded Tungdil in a firm but friendly voice.
You can drink all you like as soon as we've finished.
Bavrigor sat down sullenly, dropping the empty tankard to the floor. The hallowed library echoed with the noise.
Our first stop is the Red Range. If the Firstlings haven't heard about Nodon, we'll tell them of the danger and ask for the loan of a smith. Then we'll continue through the tunnels to our next stop, the Grey Range.
He picked up another map and laid it out in front of the dwarves.
This is an ancient map from the 5329th solar cycle, showing the main paths through the Fifthling Kingdom.
Boendal peered at the yellowing parchment.
Look, there's Flamir. That's where we'll find our dragon.
And then what?
Goimgar inquired weakly. Tungdil leaned back on his chair.
The way I see it, there's no need to actually fight the beast, when all we need is a bit of its fire. Boindil, if you dance around on its tail for a while, the rest of us can wait until it spews flames, at which point we'll jump out, light our torches, and hurry to the furnace.
Can I slay it, or am I only allowed to dance on its tail?
Asked Boindil, practically bursting with excitement. Goimgar gave him a sideways look.
If it makes you happy, you can slay it, but only after we've got the fire.
His brother instructed him firmly.
Dead dragons don't breathe flames.
The furnace is near the entrance to the stronghold.
Tungdil gave Boindil a stern look.
I know you're looking forward to killing some orcs, but the Fifthling Kingdom will be crawling with them. If you take them on, neither you nor the rest of us will come out of there alive. You're going to have to be reasonable.
Fine,
Boindil said obstreperously. He crossed his arms in front of his chest.
I won't kill the stinking orcs. Yet. I'll slaughter the lot of them when it comes to the showdown with Nodon.
He glared at the others.
Let's get this straight. If we run into orcs on the journey, the first 10 are mine. You can fight among yourselves for the others.
Not on your Nelly,
muttered Goimgar, just loud enough for Tungdil to hear. He changed the subject.
Goimgar and Bavrigor, have either of you had much experience of humans?
They shook their heads.
I'll give you some tips on dealing with them, in case we end up travelling overland for part of the way. But first, you should get some sleep. We'll be leaving in the morning.
Bavrigor and Goimgar set off in the direction of their chambers.
What about us?
Asked Boendal.
We've got some exploring to do.
Tungdil and the twins followed a stairway that wound deeper and deeper inside the mountain, taking them toward the ancient tunnels that had carried their forefathers through Girdlegard at incredible speed. Tungdil walked in front with the map, while Boindil and Boendal trailed behind, staring wide-eyed at galleries and passageways whose existence they had never suspected. None of their folk had entered this part of the kingdom since it had been contaminated by sulfur hundreds of cycles before. The air smelled dank and a little staler than usual, but there was no hint of gas. From time to time, they came across a skeleton of a sheep or a goat that had lost its way and died a slow and painful death of thirst. They followed the stairway for what seemed like hours. Broad-backed bridges of stone carried them over plunging chasms, whose depths shone with a mysterious yellow glow. They passed mighty waterfalls and many columned chambers as splendid as their own great hall. Overcome with wonderment, they walked in silence, hearing only the tread of their boots and the sound of rushing water. Soon the path sloped upward again.
"To think these shafts have been here all the time," said Boindil, unable to keep quiet any longer. "It's what happens when things aren't used. They get forgotten. I bet it's been free of poisonous gases for ages," his brother remarked.
"Aha!" Tungdil pointed to a door measuring 4 paces wide and 3 paces high, and inlaid with golden runes.
"This must be it."
They held up their oil lamps and scraped away at centuries of accumulated grime until they could read the runes. The inscription was written in an ancient dwarven dialect, and it took a bit of concentration for Tungdil to work it out. At last, he recited the lines to the twins.
"Whether finding friends or fighting foes, may Vrakas be with you and bring you safely home."
As he uttered the last syllable, the door creaked back, allowing the 3 dwarves to enter. Inside was a vast chamber filled with all manner of cogs, their teeth meshing vertically and horizontally in a confusion of rust and verdigris. Various rods connected them to a series of cauldron-like vessels, and the apparatus was topped with chimneys of all shapes and sizes. There were hatches below. Boendal studied the machinery with interest.
"To think the 3 of us have restored to life a forgotten miracle of science," he said reverently.
"Not yet, we haven't."
Tungdil took a closer look at the cauldrons and discovered slim tubes of glass, each with a single leaden ball. The tubes were calibrated and the cauldrons marked with the dwarven symbol for water. He knelt down to look inside the hatches and came across traces of ash. He laughed and thumped the sheet of metal.
"Bavrigor would say it's a distillery, but I reckon it's some kind of engine."
"How does it work, scholar?"
asked Boendal, while his brother disappeared behind the array of cauldrons and crankshafts. Tungdil had seen diagrams of similar devices in Lot Ionan's books.
"Think of it as a kind of mill," he explained. "The gears turn and drive the equipment."
"Look at this,"
called Boindil from the far side of the machinery.
"There's more stuff over here."
They followed. At the center of the chamber was a starting ramp with 8 metal rails sloping gently toward 8 closed doors. The uppermost end of 4 of the rails terminated in a wooden barrier, slung over with decaying sacks of straw.
"Those must be tracks for the wagons," said Boendal.
Tungdil nodded.
"We'll be gliding along a monorail. It's 100% safe."
"Try telling that to Goimgar," joked Boendal.
Tungdil glanced across at Boindil, who had discovered a depot of 100 or so wagons in a corner of the hall.
"Let's take a look."
There were various different designs of wagon. Some boasted 10 narrow benches, while others had a single seat and were obviously meant for freight. Near the front of each vehicle was a lever. Tungdil took hold of one and jiggled it gently. There was a squeaking sound from below. He peered beneath the carriage.
"Brakes," he announced. "If you pull on the lever, the wagon slows down. We'll have to scrape off the rust, though."
"Hang on, scholar," said Boendal. "How do you propose to lift the wagons onto the rails?"
He glanced at the starting ramp, which was 2 paces high at its uppermost end.
"They're too heavy for us to carry."
"True,"
Tungdil pointed to the ceiling.
"But look up there." "Hoists! We can use the hooks to raise the wagons and place them on the rails. I say we give it a go and see what happens."
They collected some leftover charcoal and set light to it with their oil lamps. Next, they set out to fill at least 1 cauldron, which they did by drawing water from a pool at the bottom of a nearby waterfall.
"What now?"
Boindil asked eagerly.
"We wait," said Tungdil.
They dozed for a while, worn out from their exertions, until Boindil woke up and grabbed Tungdil's arm.
"Look!" he shouted. "The lead ball just moved!"
Tungdil sat up. The ball had risen and was dancing excitedly halfway up the glass tube. Hot steam shot from 2 of the vents.
"Well, well,"
exclaimed Boendal, watching attentively to see what happened next. The crankshaft turned on its axis, and the first of many gears screeched into action, achieving half a rotation before grinding to a halt. A third valve opened, and a hiss of air escaped. "It's powered by steam," explained Tungdil, full of admiration for the engineers who had designed the contraption millennia ago. "It's like a water wheel, except it's turned by steam instead of water." The twins looked at him blankly. "Surely you must have tried holding a lid on a boiling pan."
"What do you think I am?"
Bowindel said testily.
"A cook!"
His brother understood what Tungdil was getting at.
"The steam turns the gears, and the gears power the hoist, so the wagons can be lifted onto the rails without us breaking our backs."
He looked at the thicket of rods and wheels.
"It'll take more than just one cauldron of water to get that going."
"It shouldn't be a problem," said Tungdil. "We're leaving tomorrow morning, and by then we'll..." Bowindel spun round and glared at the door.
"Did you hear that?"
he growled, already keyed up for a fight.
"An orc by the sounds of it," teased Tungdil. "You'd better go and look."
"Too right."
He set off at a jog, stopping to peer both ways at the door. Picking up a stone, he weighed it in his hands and turned to the right, only to whirl round and cast his missile into the shadows. There was a loud squeal, then the rapid patter of footsteps in the darkness. Tungdil saw a small yet somehow familiar silhouette dart past the entrance where Ironheart was waiting, axe in hand. The creature was too quick for him.
"What was it?"
Tungdil asked Boendal.
"Did you see anything?"
"No, but from the way it took off, I shouldn't think it was a threat."
He watched his brother traipse back dejectedly.
"Shame it wasn't an orc," he grumbled. "I would have killed the little critter if it hadn't been so fast."
"We're nearly done here anyway," said Tungdil. He pointed to the row of 8 doors.
"We can head back once we've had a look at these."
"Even I know what's behind them," protested Boindil,
who had been longing to whet his axe on a worthy opponent.
"Rails, that's what."
There were 8 levers at the top of the starting ramp. Tungdil pulled the one next to the first rail, and the corresponding door swung open. The rail continued through the opening into utter darkness.
"It's going to be quite some journey," said Boindil. "We'll be as good as blind in there. It's darker than a troll's backside."
His brother laughed.
"Stop exaggerating. You know perfectly well we don't have any trouble seeing in the dark."
Even so, he had to concede that the tunnel would pose a considerable challenge. Visibility was limited to about 10 paces.
"The Longins would need torches," he said.
"We should use torches as well," Tungdil told them. "If we get too accustomed to the darkness, we'll be dazzled by the least bit of light. What happens if there's a cleft in the rock? Even the tiniest chink of sunshine would blind us."
Boindil, always the intrepid explorer, disappeared through the opening and took a few paces along the rail. Tungdil read the inscription chiseled into the wall.
"It leads to the Firstling Kingdom,"
he announced for the benefit of the twins. He was beginning to understand how the underground network had worked.
4 of the rails carried outgoing passengers away from Ogre's death, and the other 4 were for wagons returning home. The wooden barriers and straw sacking served to absorb the impact in case the brakes failed.
He turned the matter over in his mind and paced along the row of doors.
"Look at this," he exclaimed, stopping suddenly. "There's even a tunnel to the Thirdling Kingdom."
Maybe the folks were more united back then. Why else would they build a tunnel to Lorimbo's dwarves?
"It's probably so we can attack them,"
boomed a hollow voice inside the tunnel.
"By the beard of Vrakas, it's pretty tight in here,"
cursed Boindil.
"No more than a dwarf's breadth either side of the wagon, I reckon."
Tungdil ignored Boindil's typically warlike explanation of the tunnel's purpose and chivied him along.
"It's time to get going."
"Hang on, I'm nearly at the end and— Whoa! The tunnel goes straight down! We better not tell Goimgar or he'll die of fright."
Boindil's muffled laughter grew louder as he finished his reconnoiter and returned.
"Look at the state of me!"
He was covered from head to toe in spiderwebs, the desiccated corpses of countless insects sticking to his beard. He fished the cobwebs from between the rings of his tunic and dusted his whiskers.
"There's obviously plenty of wildlife in the tunnels," observed Tungdil,
reaching for the lever to close the first door. Boindil sighed.
"And all of it totally harmless. Still, any spider more than so big..."
he said, measuring out a space the size of his head,
belongs to me.
They all laughed. Before they made their way home, they put out the fire beneath the cauldron and locked the door by reciting the verse. Without the sun to guide him, Tungdil wasn't sure how long it had taken to climb the hundreds of steps from the bustling heart of the kingdom to the Forgotten Hall, but it seemed from his rumbling stomach that they had been walking for some time. They were sweaty and tired when they finally joined the other delegates in the dining hall. Ignoring the curious glances cast in their direction, they sat down wearily at the table.
"We won't show them the tunnels until tomorrow," Tungdil told the twins. "The last thing we need is for Gundogar to rush off and get ahead. We'll have our work cut out racing him to the Grey Range as it is."
"What are you complaining about?"
grinned Boindil, cutting a slice of fungi about the size of his plate and sprinkling it with pungent cheese.
"You've got the best warriors, haven't you? Nodon's days are numbered, just you wait and see."
"Boindil's right," said his twin, "although there is one thing that bothers me. Remember the description of Keenfire?"
"Which part?"
"The purest, hardest steel for the blade, stone for the spurs, precious metals for the inlay, not to mention diamonds for the bit,"
Boindil reeled off.
"We'll take everything with us," said Tungdil, guessing the nature of his concern. "I asked Belendalin to supply us with ingots and gems. He said that our task was important enough to merit a donation from the Secondling's hoard. He's giving us everything we need. Gold, silver, palladium, vracassium, tionium, and a handful of diamonds. Vracus almighty! Every bandit in Girdlegad will be after us.
Don't forget the steel, granite, victuals, and other provisions,"
Boindil reminded them.
"I know we've got sturdy legs, but not even an ogre could carry that much."
"If everything goes to plan, we'll be travelling by wagon, so we won't need to worry about transporting the materials. And if we're forced to leave the tunnels, we'll buy a pony to carry our valuables. It'll be fine, you'll see."
The twins said nothing and focused on their supper, but Tungdil knew from their silence that they were unconvinced.
"Fine, what do you propose we do? Quarry the ancient mines of the Fifthling Kingdom for precious metals and steel?"
He sighed and reached for a morsel of cheese.
"We could take some extra diamonds and buy the precious metals on the way. In fact, we could buy the metals once we get there,"
suggested Boindil.
"Too risky," ruled Tungdil. "What if we end up with no tionium? We'd be missing a vital component of the axe."
He raised his fourth tankard to his lips and emptied it in a single draught. "The decision